Chapter 39. Sudden Death. Neanderthals turn down croquet offer. Article in The Toad, July 24, 1988. A group of Neanderthals unwisely turned down an exciting and unrepeatable offer from the Gloucester Meteors yesterday, following their astonishing performance at the 1988 Whackers vs. Mallets Superhoop on Saturday. The generous offer of 10 brightly coloured glass beads was rejected by a Neanderthal spokesman, who declared that conflict, howsoever staged, was inherently insulting. The offer was raised to a set of solid-bottomed cookware, and this was also roundly rejected. A spokesman for the Meteors later stated that the Neanderthal tactics displayed on Saturday were actually the result of some clever tricks taught them by the Mallets team coach. "Good work," said Alf, as we sat on the ground, panting hard. I had lost my helmet in the scrum somewhere, but hadn't until now noticed. My armour was dirty and torn. My mallet handle had split, and there was a cut on my chin. The whole team was muddy, bruised, and worn out. But we were still in with a good chance. "What order?" asked the umpire, referring to the sudden death penalty shootout. It worked quite simply. We took it in turns to hit the peg, each time moving back 10 yards. There were 6 lines all the way back to the boundary. If we got them all, we started again until someone missed. Alf looked at the players who were still able to hold a mallet and put me 7th. So if it went round again, I was on the easiest 10-yard line. "Biffo first, then Aubrey, Stig, Dorf, Warg, Grunk and Thursday." The umpire jotted down our names and moved away. I went to see my family in Landen again.
"What about the steamroller?" he asked.
"What about the steamroller?"
"Didn't it nearly run you over?"
"An accident, Land. Gotta go. Bye." The 10-yard line was simple. Both players hit the peg with ease. The 20-yard line was still no problem. The crowd roared as Redding hit the peg first, but our side roared equally when we hit ours. 30 yards was no problem either. Both teams hit the peg, and we all moved back to the 40-yard line. From this distance, the peg was tiny, and I didn't see how anyone could hit it. But they did. First Stern for Redding, then Dorf for us. The crowd roared its support. But then there was a slight rumble of thunder, and it began to rain, the full significance of which was yet to dawn.
"Where are they going?"
asked Aubrey, as Stig, Grunk, Dorf and Warg ran off to find shelter.
"It's a Neanderthal thing," I explained, as the rain increased dramatically to a downpour, the water streaming down our armour and onto the turf. "Neanderthals never work, play, or even stand in the rain if they can help it.
Don't worry, they'll be back as soon as it stops."
But it didn't stop.
50-yard penalty, announced the umpire. O'Farthens for the Whackers, and Mr. Warg for the Mallets.
I looked at Warg. He was sitting on the bench under the stands, staring at the rain, with a mixed expression of respect and wonder.
"He's going to lose us the game," muttered Jam in my ear. "Can't you do something?"
I ran across the soggy green to Warg, who stared at me blankly when I implored him to come and take the penalty.
"It's raining," replied Warg, "and it's only a game. It doesn't really matter who wins, does it?"
"Stig," I implored.
"We'd work in the rain for you, Thursday, but we've taken our turn already. Rain is precious. It gives life. You should respect it more, too."
I returned to the 50-yard line as slowly as I could to try to give the rain time to finish. It didn't.
"Well?" demanded Jam.
I shook my head sadly. "I'm afraid not. Winning has never been of any interest to the Neanderthals. They played only as a favour to me." Aubrey sighed.
"We'd like to delay the next penalty until it stops raining," announced Twizzet, who had appeared holding a newspaper over his head.
He was on legal marshland with this request, and he knew it. The umpire asked the Whackers if they wanted to delay, but O'Farthen stared at me and said that he didn't. So the next person on the list took her turn at the 50-yard line. Me. I wiped the rain from my eyes and tried to even see the peg. The rain was coming down so heavily that the cascading droplets created a watery haze a few inches above the turf. Still, I had the second shot. O'Farthen's might miss too. The Whackers' captain concentrated for a moment, swung, and connected well. The ball went sailing high towards the peg and seemed set to hit it fairly and squarely. But with a loud plop, it landed short. There was an expectant rumble from the crowd. The word was relayed up the field. O'Farthen's had landed 4 feet from the peg. I had to get closer than that to win the super hoop. Good luck, said Aubrey, giving my arm a squeeze. I walked up to the 50-yard line, the now muddy ground oozing around my boots. I removed my shoulder pads and cast them aside, made a few practice swings, wiped my eyes, and stared at the multicolored peg that somehow seemed to have retreated another 20 yards. I squared up in front of the ball and shifted my weight to maintain the right poise. The crowd went silent. They didn't know how much was riding on this, but I did. I didn't dare miss. I looked at the ball, stared towards the peg, looked at the ball again, clasped the handle of my mallet and raised it high in the air, then swung hard into the ball, yelling out as the wood connected and the ball went sailing off in a gentle arc. I thought about Cain and Goliath, of Landon and Friday, and the consequences if I missed. The fate of all life on this beautiful planet decided on the swing of a croquet mallet. I watched as my ball plopped into the soggy ground, and the groundsman dashed ahead to compare distances. I turned away and walked back through the rain towards Landon. I had done my best, and the game was over. I didn't hear the announcement, only a roar from the crowd. But whose crowd? A flashbulb went off, and I felt dizzy as the sounds became muted and everything appeared to slow down. Not in the way that my father could engineer, but a post-adrenaline moment when everything seems odd and other. I searched the seating for Landon and Friday, but my attention was distracted by a large figure dressed in a duster coat and hat who had vaulted over the barrier and was running towards me. He drew something from his pocket as he ran, his feet throwing up great splashes of muddy water on his trousers. I stared at him as he came closer and noticed that his eyes were yellow and beneath his hat were what appeared to be horns. I didn't see any more. There was a bright white flash, a deafening roar, and all the rest was silence.